nanohub.org.
The Discovery Lecture Series was started in 2005 by the support from Lilly Endowment. The purpose of Lilly Discovery Lecture Series is to bring distinguished speakers around the globe to Purdue to discuss topics of interest to our students, faculty, staffs, friends and alumni, and finally to non-specialist audience. Through this partnership with the Lilly Endowment, Purdue has brought some of the brightest minds to the campus for distinguished lectures on nanotechnology, global business development in life sciences and healthcare. Today's topic is very relevant to the United States and India. Historically, Purdue has worked very closely with Indian institutions. Recently, the activities between Purdue and India have expanded. The main catalyst has been a signing of an Indo-US Science and Technology Agreement. On October 17, 2005, a historic agreement to foster science and technology cooperation between India and the United States was signed by the Minister, Indian Minister for Science and Technology, Shri Kapil Sibal, and the U.S. Secretary of State, Dr. Condoleezza Rice. The cooperation is based on shared responsibilities and equitable contributions and benefits commensurate with the respective scientific and technological strengths and resources of the two countries. The agreement establishes a framework for dynamic and effective cooperation between organizations and individual scientists from the two countries. Now it is my great honor to introduce Dr. Victor Lichtenberg. He has served as Purdue's Vice Provost of Engagement since 2004, and this week was named as Interim Vice President for Government Relations. So he's going to make some introductory remarks. Please welcome him. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's a real pleasure and honor for me to have the opportunity to get properly wired.
Get you properly wired, yep. There
we go. To have the opportunity to say a few words of welcome and to just recount for you the importance of the relationship between Purdue University and scientific community in India. Maybe we should talk about the relationship between India and Indiana. It has a nice ring to it. Purdue, as you all know, has been involved with India for quite a long time, and our early efforts date back to 1963 when Purdue was part of a consortium that helped develop and set up the Indian Institute of Technology at Kanpur. And that continues today. We continue to be very active. We've got a number of agreements, as Pankaj indicated, student exchanges and programs. This past August, we had a workshop on energy transport and conversion and efficiency with Indian universities in Bangalore. A similar program earlier was on biotechnology and pharmaceuticals in Hyderabad, India. We've got a couple of students from Discovery Park this summer on an exchange program with the Tata Institute of Fundamental Research and the National Center for Biological Research in Bangalore. And the list goes on. This relationship is alive and well. Professor Fisher and a student spent several months in late 2007 and early 2008 in India doing work on carbon nanotube research in the Center for Advanced Scientific Research. And currently we have about 25% of Purdue's international students are Indian students, 1,200 students. That's a good number of you here today. In addition, we have over 100 Indian origin faculty at Purdue, many of them in engineering and science and management and agriculture. Interestingly, too, if you're not aware, we have over 800 alumni in India. And one of the most distinguished is the gentleman we're fortunate to have with us here today and his wife. It's a great honor to introduce our distinguished Purdue alumnus from India, Professor C.N.R. Rao. Some of you I know Professor Rao. He's a national research professor and a Linus Pauling research professor, honorary president of the National Center for Advanced Scientific Research in Bangalore. He's chairman of the Scientific Advisory Council to the Prime Minister, the Government of India. He's distinguished research scientist, published, authored over 1,200 publications and 37 books. I had the opportunity to have breakfast with him and his wife this morning. Delightful people. They look remarkably well for having just arrived from India last night in Indiana. He received an honorary degree from 35 institutions and will receive another such recognition this weekend. He's a fellow of the Royal Society of London, received numerous awards and recognitions. Earlier today, as you know, he gave a distinguished lecture in the College of Science Centennial Lecture on nanomaterials during the launch of the symposium on the Center for Analytical Instrumentation in the Bentley Bioscience Center. So please join me in giving an Indiana welcome to our guest from India, Professor Rao.
Thank you for your kind words. Nice to be back here at Purdue. Well, I've been coming back and forth for years. Well, I think it was 50 years ago I got my doctorate here. Exactly 50 years ago. Maybe a few months more. And, well, you know, that was a time when Purdue was in the backwoods of this country. And it was well known as a university, technical university. But once you came here, you could not get out of here. It's very difficult. And I guess there are many professors who came there who are still here now, I see. But I tell you, but whatever I am worth in this world, I published a lot. I got elected to all the academies in the world, including all the three academies in this country. But I owe all of that, I think, to my education at Purdue. I owe a lot to Purdue, no doubt about that. But when I was here, I did a lot of things. I published a lot of papers, you may not believe it. My PhD was a very trivial part of my research here. I published half a dozen papers out of my PhD, but I published another 20 papers outside that with a lot of professors in physics, chemistry, a number of subjects. But with this kind of a thing, then I went to Berkeley. I was there as a postdoc for a couple of years, and Berkeley was an eye-opener. I didn't know that America had such interesting parts like Berkeley, going from the Midwest here. But anyway, everything was wonderful. But when I decided to go back to India, it was a very definite decision on my part to work in this life in India only. Quite an easy part would have been to work in this country. But nobody believed that I was leaving the United States because I'd assimilated myself very, very nicely with the academic community here. And having gone to this publishing racket, I had gone into publishing papers. It was very easy to get into the American academia. But anyway, when I went back, I went as a young staff member in what was then and what is still the best Indian institute, named the Indian Institute of Science. I went to the chemistry department and had absolutely no facilities. I was to do spectroscopy here. There was nothing called a spectrometer in the chemistry department. The only spectrometer worth anything was with Professor C.V. Raman in the Raman Institute. And I wanted to build a furnace, do a little experiment. I had to you had to make your own furnace. So what do you do? Well, somewhere I wrote to my friend who sent it as a package somewhere from abroad, some wire, Canthal wire, which I wound, and eventually started doing some work on solid-state chemistry, doing some crystal structure transformations. And slowly, thanks to Professor Raman and others, I started doing some spectroscopy experimental work as well. Anyway, it doesn't matter. We were in a bad shape. India, after freedom, nobody knew what was coming. But we all did science, thinking there was some hope in science. Because we had a prime minister, Mr. Nehru, who thought much of science. He even passed a famous science policy resolution where he said, India's future is closely tied up with science. And he also said, the benefits that accrue from the practice of science must come to all mankind within India. And he was an extraordinary believer in not only in the scientific pursuit, but also that what science can do for society. Well, we had that wonderful assurance, actually at ground level, working level, as a teacher, as a university professor, or as a young faculty member like I was when I went back, there was a very big gap. And not only that, there was nothing called foreign exchange. You couldn't get a dollar. Just if you want to buy $1, it was not possible. I still was recounting the other day, the first time I went there, and eventually about three years later, I had to come to Washington for an international conference. And I, of course, came to Purdue. Every time I came to this country, I used to visit Purdue. In 62, I even taught a summer school here. Summer school, one course. And then worked for 4 months with Professor Mulliken in the University of Chicago at that time. And then 1962, when I came, the government of India used to allow $8 as the foreign exchange for anybody who went abroad. And here I was, $8 came by a Boeing plane from India, landing in New York. I was wondering, what do I do? How do I get to Maryland, where the international conference is? Well, I'd written to many, many friends so that at least one of them would show up in the airport. Thank it's nice to recollect that. We came from those days. But of course, in spite of that, there were many people in India who were doing serious research. I'm not saying no to that. But that research that we did, there was a big gap in facilities, big gap in equipment, and so on. And it was those early days that Mr. Nehru took decisions to establish new institutions, like our atomic energy program, setting up the new IITs. In fact, when the first IIT was set up, I was one of the first research scholars to go there, because the first director of the IIT, the first director, went from the Indian Institute of Science, where he was a director, back in Bangalore, to the first IIT. So he said, IITs can start only if there is research. So he said, there must be research scholars and undergraduates. So I was one of those research scholars who went to the very first IIT the first few months. Then I came away from there to Purdue. Well, with all those institutions that started coming up, IITs started coming up, and today we have 7 IITs. Of course, in this connection, IIT Kanpur was created in the early 60s. Well, you know, I was exhausted after 4 years of research in Bangalore with almost no facilities. But I must tell you, for those who are young, still my highest cited paper is the one I published at that time as a young staff member in Bangalore. It is cited 580 times, I think, once one of my papers from Bangalore at that time. So not to say that we didn't do good work. It was extraordinary effort to do that. But anyway, we went to Kanpur IIT. I was the first, one of the first 5 professors IIT Kanpur had. I was the professor in chemistry, head of the department, and it was a fantastic thing because some equipment started coming thanks to American assistance. And Purdue was one of the partners in building IIT Kanpur, and it was a great thing. We were in slightly better shape at that time. And in spite of these IITs, in spite of these facilities, the quality of experimental work, quality of engineering research, for example, or even scientific research, there was always a gap. I'm taking India as a whole, not of any one single institution or a single individual. The economic situation in India was not very good at all, till 60s. I wanted to know then, a poor India trying very hard. And in fact, I used to write articles here and there when people asked me to talk about things, how it was an impossible challenge that India was facing. I used to say, here was a democracy which was trying to feed millions of people who are so poor that you can't imagine, and at the same time trying to make a place for itself in the sun, competing with the best of the world in doing science and technology. How do you do these disparate things? Feeding the poor, doing high science and technology. Well, that disparate effort still continues, except the situation has changed slightly today. Well, anyway, my early research started with doing little things, but the area in which I am now rather known is the area of chemistry of materials. Very few people used to work on chemistry of materials when I started 50 years ago. Well, many people tell me, whenever I meet them, they refer to some paper and say, you know who that man is? Maybe that man, he has a similar name as yours, he would say, and probably he's dead. I said, no, it is me, and I did that then. This was about 50 years ago, you see. You know, it happens all the time. But But 50 years of research, that's what I have done in India now. But anyway, what happened around the 1980s and 90s, I used to advising science policy to Mr. Rajiv Gandhi at that time. I was in the same position I am with present Prime Minister. And many things happened. Some changes did occur in the 80s and 90s. A lot of things happened in India. One of the things is that's given slightly greater importance for science funding. We established better mechanisms, slightly improved mechanisms for science funding. Still, there was a big gap. Gap never closed up. The gap between India and the advanced countries continued. At that time, there was a very famous report of United Nations, and that in the 80s and 90s, many of you may remember, it said there are three types of countries in the world in science, it said, science and engineering. One, the advanced countries, of course, United States, advanced countries, or Europe, advanced countries. Second, countries which are prepared. Well, India was put in the countries which are prepared. And then there are the backward countries, the least developed countries like the Sudan and Cameroon and many such 43. Even now we have 43 least developed countries. I hope you all know that. You must know that. It's an unbelievable thing to see. The best university there has poorer facilities than one of the worst high schools of the United States. It's so bad. It's terrible. Well, I have been associated with the developing world in a big way as a president of the Third World Academy of Sciences. And it's really sad to see. And India was in that group. India was a backward country. There's no point mincing word developing at all. That humbug is the Western world created the word developing. What developing? Nothing. There's no food, there's no equipment, there's no college, there's no school. Everywhere is dirt. I went to a medical school. He said, this is our advanced research laboratory in clinical medicine. I went there. I said, what is this brown thing on the table? I said, I just did that. I got so much dust. I said, my God, you mean you do research in this lab with so much dust on the table? He said, no. Once in a way, we clean it. It is not so bad. And, you know, it's a completely different world. See, we belong there. India still belongs there to some extent. We came from a nothing, a world of nothing. And it is really a story of where agony and ecstasy, you may say, ecstasy not yet, but agony we have had, namely coming through nothing. In this world, it's extremely difficult to compete. How do you do research of the quality done anywhere else with nothing? But anyway, in the last few years, recent happenings have been different. Recent happenings since 1995, particularly, India, whatever it has done, it has reaped certain benefits. But what is that benefit? You know, without knowing, India was supporting education in a particular way. They didn't know that. We are supporting, for example, a number of regional engineering colleges. We never knew that they were going to be any good. We supported a lot of reasonable colleges, not great, but middle-level engineering colleges. Same with small universities, which we supported. We never knew that they were going to be worth anything. We didn't realize that. But suddenly, in 1990s, that realization since then has come. See, all the major national programs of India, the great programs, our atomic energy, our space, which have been successes because of these engineers from the smaller places. I want you to know. All the great IIT, right? Many IIT students, oh, I've taught a lot of IIT students, they didn't help India too much. They were all in the United States. All right. But the poor colleges and the poor universities, middle-level universities, the Shibpur Engineering College in Calcutta, or Suratkal Engineering College and things like that, Guindy College in Madras, they are the ones who have made us do whatever we have done in space and atomic energy. 99% of the students come from these ordinary places. So this is the one that has also helped this famous IT revolution. You know, suddenly what happened about 10 years ago when IT became important, I remember Narayan Murthy was a student in our institute. I remember him from those days. Starting, oh, let us do some information technology, little companies. Now we have got a few thousand companies, IT companies in Bangalore. Of which 350 are major companies and 50 are very big companies. And as you know, we have IT companies so big that Bangalore City, where I live, last year export was $12 billion. Bangalore is going at a rate of 15% a year, and I think the fastest growing city. All this is due to these engineers whom we produce in these ordinary colleges. And because since the IIT graduates were not available, they were available serving elsewhere. And I think we had these ordinary people. And that is a big lesson for all of us. I think America has to learn that too, because how do you produce graduates who will serve this country in the future? Because all of them, the best of them may not be available for the areas you want them in. You know, even if they're available, in fact, since there is more money selling soap than doing engineering, they start selling soap. And that is very common in India. They all go to management. You see, management is a big killer of science. IT has also been a big killer of science in India. In the name of IT, a lot of good minds have gone to third-rate computation. They have produced a lot of coolies, not original minds. See, there's a disservice also this has been done. A lot is the disservice. We produce so much IT in India, software, but we have only produced 25 PhDs in computer science per year. Terrible. So this is also what money does. You see, money is where it is available. People don't want to do PhD anymore. They do just a bachelor's degree and go to IT. So the good things that have happened, suddenly this has given rise to a very large middle class population in India. Well, don't believe what President Bush says. He says because they are all eating too much, he says India is responsible for the food shortage in the world. I mean, that is not true. I think people still eat more in this country. But what has happened is the upper middle class population of India, like Bangalore, has gone up by, in Bangalore, suddenly 1 million more middle class. So the good and bad, sociologically, it is a problem India we have. The reality is that India suddenly has seen wealth. There is wealth in India and money available, and the rate of growth of India. You know, I have been a member and associated with planning for India for a long time, and it has never been beyond 5% rate of growth. In the last year, even with the worst governance that we have, we are doing 9%. There is nothing to do with the governance and the government. The government has become irrelevant, to be honest with you, as far as growth of India is concerned. It is the private sector which has done well. Even in R&D, the private R&D in India is so large. Like, for example, General Electric in Bangalore, General Motors in Bangalore, a number of little companies, for example, Cooks and Electronics or Honeywell, a whole bunch of companies coming up. And Indian private companies are having a big R&D now. For example, Tatas have them, but Tatas have never done enough research. You know, Tatas have never been, can never be credited for doing much for research and science, but in terms of scientific research. But other companies, like Reddy's Labs or pharma sector, which is our biggest success, pharma sector, is again a success story. So I'm only giving successes to remember, you know, even though we did not know it was happening, the successes suddenly in the last few years, IT sector, pharma sector, auto sector, you know, it has been a very, very great thing. And this has helped the Indian economy in a very big way, and the rate of growth being high, it produced money, and this affects science and technology in a very big way. There's no doubt about that. Money is available for science and other things. And India has also become the provider of talent. It has provided of graduates for IT, BT, and many other things. Even many professors we provide to many places, including Purdue, I think. And that has been a very good thing. And I think India's role in the future, if you ask me what it should do, how should India go? Well, one of the things is I don't want to complain. There are two types of people in India. Of course, by the way, I was just joking with one of my friends. Indians, wherever they are, they complain. You know, that's one of the traditions of Indians. They are unhappy wherever they are. So I decided to live in India and be unhappy there. And why should I come to live in Lafayette and be unhappy here, right? I tell you, there's no need. I mean, I've never seen a happy Indian. Don't forget. So forget Indians how they feel. Joke apart, seriously speaking. What is it that we are going to do from India now on? You know, it's a very difficult thing. Ask somebody, how do you plan? In fact, our Prime Minister always joking, Professor, what should we do? I mean, you give me five things I should be doing. Well, what are those five things? Well, there are several things I would suggest. First, according to me, India should stop worrying about Indians going abroad. I think we should not complain. Let them go. Let them all go. Fine. But we produce more. So where the problem is the brightest of Indians are yet to be identified in India. You see, that is the thing I found out. My best students today come from the remote villages of Assam, Uttar Pradesh, Bengal, North Bengal, not from Calcutta, or from Assam, not from the big cities like Bombay, Bangalore. They're all finished and destroyed, doing IT. All the city folk are destroyed, you see. This money has taken over. But the villages, you see, 75% of the Indian population is in the rural sector. and it is their talent is. In fact, the top students I have are all those who come from nothing, who have no background, who are the first learners, and who are the first people get to become graduates in families. So India should concentrate on the 75% of the population which has been ignored all this time, where talent is, and that talent will serve United States also, I'm telling you. You will get them here. Because they're so smart, and you will need them. And in fact, there'll be shortage of talent everywhere when India is going to be full of young people. India, as you know, is the youngest country in the world today. We have 65% of the population below the age of 35, 55% of the population below the age of 25. Unlike the opposite is true in Europe and United States and Japan, where average age is very, very, very high. So whether it's taking care of the old people as nurses, or taking care of the young people as teachers, or doing research in universities, you'll require talent. And India's role is to provide good talent for the entire world. That's what I say. Not just for India. I think there's nothing wrong working as professors in Purdue. I've just joked with them. They can continue to work here and we'll produce more of them. But I'll continue in India. This life is India for me. So the future of India will have to do that. What about investment? How do we do that? You see, what we have suffered is India has suffered a lot because of comparisons and some real situation. Asia has become a giant. I hope you all know that. Whether you like it or not, in the next 20 years, Asia will be number one, not Europe or America. Asia will take over. Yeah, nothing can stop Asia taking over. And so it'd be nice to Asians. And then second, and also to Indians like me. Okay. Since when Asia takes over, well, you know, you must take everything with a little sense of humor. But there is a reality is, when you look at China's growth, I hope you all look at quantitatively how it is growing in science and engineering. It is frightening. I just went to university some time ago. I asked my friend Ram Das in physics is here. He will be amazed. I went to physics department, gave this lecture. They were very nice. They gave me some honorary something, made me professor. I said, how many PhD students are here? Or first I asked them, how many professors are here? They said, 350 professors. In one department? He said, yeah, 350 professors. I said, are you serious? And then I started counting, give me your book. And I said, look, I can't believe this. Well, I came with 250, so what? You know, it's a very, very big investment in numbers. And actually, there were 650 PhD students in the department in physics. I'm not joking, it's serious. So the number investment of China is so large, we are going to have a problem in India. We can never match those numbers. Amount of money invested also very large, China. China has made very, very good investment in people. They have taught us investment in people is a solution for China. Well, they've invested in industry, everything. Sure. People are being produced, large numbers. India has not been able to do that yet. And where I differ as an advisor to our prime minister and elsewhere, is I think we should improve quality more than just quantity. India has not done well in quality, neither has China. China has done equally badly. As you know, India's contribution to the top 1% of the world's research publications is only less than 1%. Well, America produces 63% of the top 1% of the papers. So we have to improve quality. So India is now trying to find solutions to these problems. How to solve the problem of quality versus quantity? Whether you like it or not, being a democracy, you cannot stop people starting institutions. Private investments will go on. At the same time, quality investment must be there. How do we balance that? So one of the things we have done is, this is one of the things that I've been responsible or I'm the father of this thing. We have started 5 new Indian Institutes of Science. You all know that. This has been a great experiment, great success under the Department of Human Resources Development. These 5 science institutes are just like IITs, but only for pure science. And they will do research and they will do undergraduate education in science. And 3 have already, 2 of them are already in the 3rd year, outstanding young boys in science. Outstanding boys and girls. Very, very, very good. And when all the 5 start working, the 5th one in Trivandrum has just started. We have appointed a new director. And when it starts, eventually, between all of them, there will be 5,000 undergraduates in science, doing only science. We have enough for engineering. I'll come to that engineering in a minute. And then there'll be similar, about 2,000-3,000 students doing PhD in these five institutes. So this is one new thing we have done. And then we have started three more IITs officially, but maybe more, unfortunately. But anyway, we're having a meeting as soon as I go back. There's a lot of problem about that. Some more IITs are getting started. Well, then for funding, we have for 2 years, we have been fighting hard to get a new National Science Foundation for India. China has made a great success of the NSF of China. And we have been wanting to have not this little funding as a little, one of those handouts that a department or a government gives, like the Department of Science and Technology, has a funding scheme, but it is one of the small items under the Department of Science. We don't want that. We want a major budget head in the national budget for science and engineering funding, and that has been created now, called the National Science and Engineering Research Board. We're about to appoint the new National Science Board, and it has a billion, it is about 50 billion rupee budget to start with, and it's a fair amount of money, and I think we'll have to find people to work on things. I think our problem will not be money, but finding good people. And in fact, these new IITs, new Indian Institute of Science coming, ICERS, the new Indian Institutes of Science are called the Indian Institute of Science Education and Research. We didn't want to call them Indian Institute of Science because there's one in Bangalore. We don't want to give it a competition. It is 100 years old. In fact, we're just celebrating the 100th year as of this year of Indian Institute of Science. So this new National Science Engineering Research Board, I think, will make a big difference to Indian science funding. Let me give a typical example, nano mission. We started a nano mission. I'm the chairman. We have tried to find everyone or anybody anywhere who can do some reasonable work. It is one of those, not too much competition is not involved. Anyone who is, all right, you come and tell us what is it you are going to do. And fund him something. Many small colleges, we are given X-ray diffractometers or AFM, atomic force microscopy. And any university which want to teach a course in nanoscience and technology, we have funded them to the tune of about 20 to 30 million rupees. So buying enough equipment to teach, so this is what we have done in the Department of Science and Technology, for example. Similarly, our Department of Biotechnology has started many programs, many programs addressed to funding young people, institutions, building institutions of excellence. This is going to increase in the next few years. Of course, what about the negative thing? Negative thing is we are a bit short of people, as I told you, because of this IT menace. Everybody going to do something mediocre work, making money. And this money, I have this story, actually. I'm giving a lecture. As the day I go back, I have to give a lecture in Bangalore. I was going to say that there is a very famous thing in the Indian scriptures. It is in the Upanishads. This wife of this great sage asks this Upanishad, in the Upanishads, if I become the most rich person in the world, will I gain immortality? The husband, who is a great sage, says, no, impossible, she says. He says. Then this wife says, then what do I do with that which does not give me immortality? So she doesn't want money. People forget, of course, today we don't do that. We say, what will I make rich without immortality is the question. So people would like to become rich first. But in India, this is a problem that we are going to face. If India is going to reach a sort of high levels of science, high levels in knowledge accumulation, gaining knowledge and making itself a power, knowledge power, then it depends on the younger generation of India. And that I can't predict today how it will turn out. We are trying to start new institutions, train the people, give them lots of opportunities. You may not believe it, we have given, as of this year, there will be 1 million scholarships for young children from villages. 1 million. Who cannot afford, we'll take care of the full tuition, stay, food, everything for 1 million children. We're trying to do as much as possible. We're a democracy. As you know what democracy is, you have a government you have to suffer with, you have a Congress you have to put up with. It doesn't mean just because somebody is a parliamentarian or a senator or a congressman, he does the good for the country. I mean, nobody knows. Nobody knows. There is a big uncertain mark in democracy. And being a democracy and accomplishing has disadvantage. I want you to know that. You know that. America need not be told. And of course, but the only hope is that democracies of the world will work together. This is the only reason I keep coming to America, keep advising, we have to work together, America and India. There's no choice. I'm not saying you shouldn't work with China or anybody. Work with anybody you want. But democracies must get together. Japan, we have to do something more. And I think in India then, I close my lecture by saying, the future sometimes looks bleak to people who are very negative in attitude. Where people like me, who has gone through a very great period in my life, 50 years in India, starting from nothing, finding various stages of development, and now come to a level where money is not a problem, where we can do research of a high quality. But let me tell you, with all these problems, the best of people in India, in spite of all the problems, have done very good work. This is a great thing about India. Some people have always done something. But that is not what being talked about. How is the average India coming up? How total of India coming up? That is why I'm saying the efforts are being made in a big way. But, well, there is uncertain future. Like, there is uncertain future for every country. I don't think you know how the future of America is. There is always that uncertainty, how the world will develop. But what is certain is, if India somehow learns to tap the young talent in our villages, they will take care. I think it is the man who makes the difference. It is the mind that makes the difference. It has never been the money that has made the difference in this world. And that those minds and men are in our villages in India. And all of them are waiting to be used, tapped, and given a chance. My hope is there. Thank you.